Hi, I'm your host, Asia Tab, and you're listening to The Spark Weekly. The 4th of July is this week, and it could be a trauma reminder for those that served in combat, went through a fire, explosion, or even gun violence. Sam Peterson is a mental health patient turned program founder at Altier Healthcare. Sam has founded both outpatient and inpatient treatment programs for veterans and first responders to receive more effective treatment for mental health. Thanks for being with us, Sam. How are you doing today?
Oh, absolutely. Doing great. Thanks for having me, Asia. I think this is, at this time of the year, it's really important to talk about how, you know, our celebrations are affecting veterans and,
Yes. You
know, like you mentioned, people who have survived gun violence.
And that brings me, first of all, I want to say thank you for your service. It's just an honor to be able to talk to you. I know you did 3 tours in Afghanistan. So what was your journey into the military? Why did you join?
Yeah. I'm like a lot of folks. I grew up in a small town in rural Washington and just wanted to get out and see the world. And the military was a great way to do that. And as soon as I signed up, went to the recruiter and he showed me a couple of recruiting videos for EOD, that's Explosive Ordnance Disposal. And I was immediately hooked. You know, we had robots and explosions.
Yeah.
It was something out of the movies, and it immediately captured, you know, my attention and my interest. And, you know, then I ended up in one of the hardest academic schools in the Department of Defense, on my way to become a bomb technician. And I loved every second of it.
Wow. And you went to Afghanistan and you did 3 tours. Were you nervous to go there? And how has that experience shaped you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the first time was definitely the most nerve-wracking. I remember, I hope it's not too morbid for your listeners, but I just remember getting out of the truck on an explosive ordnance disposal incident. So we'd roll up and there would be, an improvised explosive device someone was trying to actively use to target us, there on scene. And I just remember every time I'd get out of the truck, I would step out of the truck with my right leg first, because that's the one I was okay with getting blown off.
Wow. And,
it's a little morbid, but it's just one of those things you think about, as a soldier when you're in that kind of environment all the time.
And what years did you serve?
So I served from the beginning of 2009 to the end of 2015.
Okay. And you retired in 2015?
Mm-hmm. Yep. I didn't retire. I left the Army in 2015.
And what led you to that decision?
It was getting very difficult to just stay in the Army. I was dealing with, a lot of PTSD symptoms. And my traumatic brain injury was really starting to flare up. So, it was becoming very difficult to regulate my emotions and to not have outbursts that, would cause issues in my career. So, it was time to get out. And, that ended up, leading me into the mental health field after a while.
And you just spoke a little about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. What is that? And for you, when did you realize you were experiencing that?
Yeah, so post-traumatic stress disorder, if you just talk in broad strokes neurologically, if we look at a brain, what we see is an underactive prefrontal cortex, so an underactive executive functioning center, and an overactive amygdala. So the amygdala, the emotional center of the brain where our fight, flight, and freeze response is located, is, responsible for those emotional reactions, the panic attacks, that sort of thing. And you'll see that being overactive. So people who are triggered by, their environment, whether it's, fireworks, gunshots, what have you, the amygdala takes over and boom, all of a sudden you're back in it. You're back in that same emotional response that you had been during that time period. And Yeah, sorry, what was the second part of that question?
Oh, it was what is that trans what was that transition like coming out of the military in 2015 and realizing that you had PTSD?
It really hit home. It was right after like my second deployment. I was the one of the bomb technicians attached to a special forces team, and we were going in and hitting targets. And I just remember, being back home because I got injured and got sent home early. Being back home and walking into a Walmart to go buy a TV for a house I'd just bought, and someone like gave me an offhanded look, and immediately my brain switched into threat response, and I had a full-blown panic attack right there in Walmart. And those continued until it was almost a daily occurrence. And, it got to the point where, I was quite frankly suicidal. And just dealing with that level of anxiety and panic every day, just it was incredibly crippling.
And what would PTSD or a panic attack, what would that look like for a person watching someone experience that?
Yeah, so it's hard to see a lot of times. Everyone, shows outer signs of these differently, but I can speak from, the patient side of the house. All of a sudden elevated heart rate, you look down at your smartwatch and you're, sitting somewhere and your heart rate's in the hundreds, sweating, eyes are darting, irritability can, set in. And it's really watching someone get, into a sympathetic nervous system response. So, sweating, agitation, pacing around, that elevated heart rate, those are some pretty solid signs.
And how did you work through your PTSD?
I was really fortunate. I had, not only friends, but doctors really helped me through that process and got me in touch with a lot of what we would call alternative therapies for PTSD. And one of those that really helped me was ketamine infusion therapy. And ketamine, the reason ketamine is effective for PTSD is it basically is a control alt delete for the brain. So, if someone's having these symptoms, ketamine, they can go in, get a couple ketamine infusions and immediately get relief from that. And typically we see between 70 to 80% of patients respond after a few ketamine infusions, and it gives gives your brain, that space to start reprocessing. Because at the end of the day, what we need to do in order to treat PTSD more effectively is to reinforce the prefrontal cortex. So get it so that the prefrontal cortex has the power to tell the amygdala to calm down.
You're a veteran, so you're out of the military now. Does active duty veterans have PTSD the same way that veterans do?
Yeah, so it really the short answer is it depends. There are so many different combat facing MOSs or jobs in the military. It really just depends on the person. What have they experienced? Has there been a intensity of combat within, the past few months or years of their engagement, like with the military, or not? And typically, what we see as well is, there's that initial trauma. Some people can get over that. It causes, that PTSD response in others. And a lot of times what we'll see is like kind of a delayed fuse, if you will, where an individual will have this trauma response, and then after, a couple of years, it'll really start to manifest into full-blown PTSD, where they're having panic attacks, they can't deal with crowds, that sort of thing.
Wow. And what is the impact of PTSD on a vet's family and relationships?
I mean, it puts a severe burden on anyone's ability to function in a healthy relationship. It's you're constantly in this state of hyper arousal, and it's like anxiety on super steroids that the government made.
So, Sam, could you tell us your story and your journey?
Yeah, absolutely, Asia. So, you know, as we were talking about before, I was an Army bomb technician. So, you know, it was my job to, you know, go down and deal with improvised explosive devices. And although I really loved my job and I found it really fulfilling, you know, when I got back, the constant state of alertness that you have to have in those situations, you know, in Afghanistan, in a foreign country, it wears on you. And, you know, it got to the point where I was having panic attacks pretty much every day. And those panic attacks continued to, you know, worsen until it got to the point where I just wanted to end it all, just so quiet in my head. And, you know, I put a 45 in my mouth and I was about to ready to pull the trigger and my phone went off in my pocket. And it was one of my friends that, you know, that text message ended up saving my life. And I was able to get into these alternative therapies, you know, that we're using now in program, like ketamine infusion therapy, hyperbaric oxygen therapy, and eventually transcranial magnetic stimulation. And those treatments really got me on an upward trajectory, gave me space for my symptoms, allowed me to heal. And, you know, I didn't really realize like how much of an impact, you know, my friend reaching out and saving my life was until 5 months later. One of my mentors walked out into his backyard and shot himself with his 3-year-old kid in the house. And I was the last guy to talk to him at the unit. You just never would have known he was suffering. And that's the difficult thing, you know, about a lot of these invisible wounds is it's very hard to tell the degree to which someone is suffering. So, you know, I just want to highlight that it's really important that if you think someone's struggling, reach out and ask, because you never know when the phone call or the text message that you send is, you know, going to be that intervention that saves somebody's life.
And Sam, you are a patient turned program founder at Altier Healthcare, helping outpatient and inpatient treatment programs for veterans. So what was your journey to that and what type of programs do you offer there?
Yeah, so after Neil's suicide, it really became apparent that we needed more effective mental health care for vets and first responders. The typical talk therapy and pharmacotherapy is just not working for vets. So I co-founded an outpatient clinic called Mind Spa in Denver. And we started doing, you know, ketamine infusion therapy, hyperbaric oxygen therapy, and transcranial magnetic stimulation, along with talk therapy, for veterans and first responders who are struggling with PTSD, depression, anxiety, and traumatic brain injuries. What I was seeing, though, was we were contracted with the VA, and I was watching these veterans come in the door who were suffering from significant traumatic brain injuries and PTSD, and they couldn't access our treatments because the VA wasn't approving them. So, you know, I got an opportunity to come on board with Altior and create this inpatient experience for veterans suffering from PTSD, traumatic brain injuries, depression, and anxiety, and bring these new therapies to a program that the VA was paying for so that veterans had more access. And, you know, it's been incredibly, incredibly rewarding to see how fast we can take someone from, you know, where I was at to feeling significantly better. Like, just to give you an example, like our average time to full symptom remission within our Treat Power Up program, that's our inpatient program in Idaho, our average time to full symptom remission is between 14 to 17 days.
Wow.
Just to give you an example of, like, you know, if you were to just take like a pharmacotherapy approach, just to start to see an effect from a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, a classic antidepressant, takes between 8 to 10 weeks. And we're doing it in 2 to 3.
How can we support our veterans more dealing with PTSD?
You know, that's a good question. I think there's, you know, it comes down to, if there's a veteran in your life who's dealing with PTSD, you know, the first thing they need to know is that they're supported and that they're loved. That this is a really difficult thing to deal with for a lot of people. There's a lot of shame involved in it as well from the veteran's perspective. And they just, first of all, they need to know that, hey, they're supported and there's people in their lives that care about them and that are here to help them. At the end of the day, this stuff is treatable. We can make changes in the brain. We can rewire the brain. We have the treatment protocols to do that. And that's, you know, the other thing that vets need, that we can support vets by giving them the knowledge that they don't have to feel this way all the time, that there are treatment protocols that can be used to, you know, heal the brain and rewire it so that they're not stuck in this perpetual state. Because so often in traditional medicine, we get sold this bag of goods that you can't heal a traumatic brain injury, that you can't, you know, heal PTSD, and that's simply the case.
And Sam, you spoke about it earlier, but I wanted to talk about it again. What are the signs of PTSD, or are there any symptoms that we all should be aware of?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of learning how to recognize, you know, when someone's having a panic attack. You know, if someone, you know, is all of a sudden they go from good to go, there's a loud noise, maybe a firework goes off, and then it kicks off this hypervigilance, you know, you'll notice they'll start, you know, reacting like they're in a sympathetic nervous system response. So probably stand up, a lot of pacing, they might get sweaty, irritable, you know, looking around and looking for threats to engage with. These are, you know, all the signs that someone is having, you know, a panic attack.
For the 4th of July holidays, I'm sure we can't prevent people from doing fireworks. Is there anything that we can do to support our veterans during that time?
Yeah, I mean, the fireworks are definitely going to happen. A strategy that I used to take was I would just go into my basement with some Bose headphones on and like just watch a movie marathon. That way, like I had something that was noise canceling, so I wasn't hearing the fireworks like go off randomly all the time, and could just focus it on something. And I mean, I think, you know, unfortunately, avoidance is a strategy. It's, you know, in mental health, we don't like to say that, but in this instance, I think it's very apt.
Sam, how has your life changed from being a veteran to dealing with PTSD to now being a mental health counselor, helping other veterans go through what you went through?
You know, it's really rewarding to be able to show these individuals that, you know, not only is there hope, but we can help get them better in a pretty rapid clip and help them stay better. You know, I don't think you can ever fully get rid of PTSD, but we can certainly turn down the volume significantly on the effect that the amygdala is having, you know, over the brain.
And for a veteran that is listening that would like to be a part of your program, how can they reach you or join?
Yeah. If you're listening and, you know, what I've been saying sounds good and you're like, hey, that's me, I need help, our Patriot Power Up program can be found at www.patriotpowerup.com, and just give us a call. We're happy to help. We are in network with VA Community Care, So we are here to provide a more effective, you know, treatment protocol for these issues.
Sam, I want to thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Is there anything that I may have missed that you feel we didn't cover that you would like to put out there?
No, I really think that they hit everything. As far as like something I'd like to put out there, you know, just talking to all the vets out there, you know, you are not alone. What you're going through right now is treatable. We have the protocols and the treatments in place so that we can help you. You do not have to suffer alone. You don't have to suffer in silence. We can make it so that this is not your normal, and we can bring you back to the person you were before.
Thank you so much, Sam, for sharing your story with us. Coming up after the break, we'll hear from a professor at Franklin and Marshall College that conducted a study measuring the human rights protecting the LGBTQ+ community. In studio, we have Dr. Susan Dicklich-Nelson, professor at Franklin and Marshall College, also founder and principal investigator of the FNM Global Barometers. We're also being joined by Aaron Hallenbach, project manager and research associate with the FNM Global Barometers. Could you explain to us what exactly is the project and what does it measure?
Yeah, great. I'm happy to do that. So the FNM Global Barometers is actually three different projects. It's the FNM Global Barometer of Gay Rights, the FNM Global Barometer of Transgender Rights, and the FNM Global Barometer Perception Index. And what we do with these three different instruments is measure how human rights protecting or persecuting countries are towards LGBTQI+ minorities.
And what did you find right here in Central PA?
Well, with the Perception Index, we found that in Pennsylvania overall, it scored a C, which, you know, you look at a grading score, C is not great. It's not an F, but it's a C. In the Susquehanna Valley in particular, we scored a little bit better than Pennsylvania overall. In the United States, it was a C, but again, Pennsylvania was doing better than the United States overall.
How do you conduct the survey?
So we've partnered with many different organizations, and what we did is we asked six simple questions. How safe do you feel? Have you experienced violence in the last year? Have you experienced discrimination? How accepted do you feel? And how safe do you feel in gathering? And so we had the survey for 3 months. It was held in 2022, and we were able to get over 171,000 responses globally.
Dr. Dicklich-Nelson, what made you feel that you needed to do this research?
That's a great question, Asia. Clearly, LGBTQ+ rights, human rights were lagging in the world. There was, you know, people have perceptions on how well LGBTQ+ people are treated, but we didn't have any real hard data. And so I wanted to collect data to be able to show what the actual reality is in terms of legislation protecting LGBTQ+ people, but also the lived reality.
And that also brings me to my next question. Do you believe the Fairness Act will help the LGBTQ+ communities feel more safe?
Well, the Fairness Act of Pennsylvania, yes. I think it's one step, right? Legislation is just one step in the process. If society is not accepting, it's not enough. But if you have legislative protections, at least you have the law on your side. So it is very important to pass that.
Was there any part of the survey that surprised either of you?
I think one thing that surprised me was the fact that there is a lot of hate between different groups within the LGBT community.
Really?
Yeah. So one thing in our survey is that we also collected comments. People could write in a comment about anything they wanted. And we actually found that there was a lot of transphobia and queerphobia within the LGBT community. People who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, writing that, you know, everything would be fine for us if it weren't for those queer, flamboyant people or for those transgender people. So I think the survey actually, while unfortunate, it was important that we capture this and that we can actually work towards, you know, more solidarity within the LGBTQ community, because right? If trans people are targeted, LGBT people will also be targeted as well. We're all in this together.
Aaron, could you explain the difference to us between transphobia and queerphobia? I think that's what you just said.
Yeah, so transphobia specifically would be a hatred or a fear of transgender people. And then queerphobia would be a hatred or fear of people who identify as queer or non-binary or anywhere else on the LGBTQ spectrum.
You also said, Dr. Dicklish Nelson, that Pennsylvania received a C in the human rights related issues related to the LGBTQ plus community, according to the survey. What else stood out to you?
Well, it became clear to us, and this is not just in Pennsylvania, but globally, that yes. trans people, trans women and trans men felt less safe, felt more fearful of violence than some of the other groups, lesbian, gay, bisexual individuals. I think it was also very clear to us in Pennsylvania that, like in the United States, acceptance or feeling accepted by the straight community was much lower, and that's a problem. But they did feel safer in Pennsylvania than they did in other places, obviously in the world, in places like Uganda or Ghana or Nigeria, but also in other places like Alabama or Texas or Florida.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting just from a statistical perspective that in the United States and then breaking it down in Pennsylvania that, as Susan just said, question two, acceptance, was the lowest scoring question as opposed to experiences with violence or discrimination. People seem to feel that the state of acceptance is the lowest for them.
And speaking of acceptance in that, we look back at like the Stonewall Uprising in Pride Month. Mm-hmm. How far have we come, or have we moved forward since that event took place?
Well, we've moved forward in the sense that we have more legislative protections in the United States. For example, marriage equality has been passed. You have employment non-discrimination that's been passed. So those are really important milestones. But we still have a long way to go in terms of overall acceptance. And I think we have to be concerned about the anti-LGBTQ plus rhetoric that seems to be pervasive right now in the United States, but also globally in terms of the far right pushing anti-LGBTQ plus rhetoric.
The rhetorical tactics that were around during the Stonewall riots are almost the same today. I mean, a little bit of a different flavor, but this idea, right, that LGBTQ people or specifically transgender people are grooming young people, or LGBT people are pedophiles. That was the same kind of stuff we saw back then. I mean, for example, Harvey Milk was campaigning to ensure that teachers could stay teaching in public schools. And we're seeing that again right now with the Don't Say Gay bill in Florida. A lot of, you know, vitriol and upset over what's happening in public schools and with children. And that was around back then as well. So the tactic is kind of the same, even though we do have more legislative protections now.
The survey looked at violence and discrimination. Mm-hmm. Do people here in the LGBTQ plus community, do they feel safe here?
Safe in Pennsylvania or safe in the Susquehanna Valley?
Could I ask for both?
Sure. It's all relative. I mean, they feel safe. They feel safer here than they do, like I said, in places like Texas or Florida or Idaho, for that matter. But I think the acceptance level is less. And I think we need to look at that. Why do LGBTQ plus people feel less accepted? Like, for example, in Lancaster, where I live, a few months ago, we had the drag story queen issue at the library.
I remember that.
Was,
yes.
Right. It was really horrible, where there was a bomb threat that was called in. And actually, I think they thought it was coming from Nigeria, but why would someone from Nigeria care about what's going on in Lancaster? So we're kind of trying to figure that one out, but
could be a VPN,
right?
You know, trying to disguise location.
Right. Exactly. But when you have things like that, people are now afraid to actually come together and celebrate in Pride because of bomb threats or threats for safety. I mean, the Pulse incident, you know, that still is very, very close in our minds in terms of what happened, where LGBTQ plus people are being targeted and killed simply because of who they are.
What do you hope comes out of this survey and research?
It's a great question. I think awareness. I think it's important for people to understand, people outside of the LGBTQ plus community, that the reality for LGBTQ plus people is very different in terms of their perception of how they're treated, how they're accepted, and how safe they feel than how many people might actually think it is. Like, people think, well, what's the problem, right? We have same-sex marriage. We have employment non-discrimination protections. Why are you afraid? What's the problem? But when you continually have this anti-LGBTQ plus rhetoric, and as Aaron said, when you make that association and suggest that LGBTQ plus people are pedophiles or they're grooming in some way, that is really, really dangerous, and that is going to spread fear in the LGBTQ plus community.
How can someone help you with their research? They're listening and they say, I really want to be involved with this project.
Mm-hmm. Well, if they're a member of the LGBTQ plus community, they can take the survey. We're going to be launching a 2024 survey in August, so we encourage them to take that survey. I think it's also to educate, if you're outside or even within the LGBTQ plus community, educate yourself about what's going on. And if you see something, say something. Be an ally. Don't be a bully. Don't contribute to the hate and the anti-LGBTQ plus rhetoric.
Yeah, there's so much misinformation out there that's purposely created to be misinformation. So, making sure that, as Susan just said, educating yourself and critically thinking about why people are saying this about LGBTQ people. What is the end goal? So that's one way to help out.
So Aaron, why did you decide you wanted to be a part of this project? How did you get involved?
Thinking back about 2 years now, I got involved primarily at first because I'm an alumni of Franklin and Marshall College, where the project is based out of, and I also have a master's in women's gender and sexuality studies. So I wanted to do something that was obviously using that knowledge set. And I think what drew me to the FNM Global Barometers was the fact that it's so comprehensive. There's not many places that are tracking this information in a reliable and objective way. So the fact that the project was covering 204 countries, also serving the LGBT population, which has never been done before, that's really what drew me to the project.
Is there anything that was surprising that you found through your research here? Or is there anything that just wasn't surprising at all, where you said, okay, I expected that?
Sure. I guess one thing that was not surprising, which is the fact that trans rights lag behind LGB rights. On the FNM Global Barometer of Transgender Rights, the scores overall across the world are much lower than the scores on the FNM Global Barometer of Gay Rights. The world mean is lower, for example, on the GBTR, the Trans Rights Barometer, versus the Gay Rights Barometer. So that was not surprising to me. But I think what was also exciting about this data point is just that we're actually quantifying that reality. We're not just saying it. And then we're able to actually use that information to push policymakers, to help researchers, and also to help activists and advocates use this information to do their thing. So that was exciting as well.
When you two look at the research, did you find these issues were more prominent with younger or older members of the LGBTQ plus community?
Right. So one of the things that stood out to us, which was a little surprising, was younger LGBTQ plus individuals felt less safe. They felt less accepted. They felt more discriminated against than some of the individuals 55 and older that took the Perception Index survey.
That's interesting. I wonder where that stems from, only because there's so many more social media movements. Mm-hmm. There's been legislation to mm-hmm. help them. And then also all the Pride festivities. Mm-hmm. What played into that? Or do you have an idea? Or did they mm-hmm. speak about that?
Well, I think part of it might be, and we can hypothesize on this, but you mentioned Stonewall before.
Yes.
So for many older LGBTQ plus individuals, they went through Stonewall. They had to riot to get their rights. And so perhaps their expectations were a lot lower than some of the younger LGBTQ plus individuals who have felt like, hey, what's going on? Homosexuality is decriminalized in the United States, but we're still being treated as second-class citizens. I think the other thing that we're also seeing is a lot of younger people are identifying as non-binary and queer. And I think society is kind of confused about that, to be honest. And so they don't quite know what to do with that. And I think that might also reflect this sense of not being accepted or understood.
Yeah, I think younger people, too, are generally more educated on these topics and more open and accepting of people within their community. And so in that sense, their expectations of what is right or what they deserve in terms of legislation is higher than perhaps older people who, right, were kind of, they expected the bare bones, same-sex marriage, things like that. So I think that could be one reason as well. And I think also this interesting data point that we discovered about how younger people actually, they scored worse on our survey. That's an example of the power of the F&M Global Barometers. That's a research question that we've produced with our data. And now other organizations, other researchers can take that information and try to continue to hypothesize with us about why that is. So that's like that's one of the things that we actually can do for the world.
You also spoke about being an ally and not being a bully. What exactly is an ally, and how does a person go about being an ally?
That's a great question. Well, an ally is someone who's supportive of the LGBTQ plus community, someone who is not attacking individuals because of their sexual orientation or gender identity, someone who speaks out when they see discrimination, not staying quiet or being part of that, or even bullying someone because they might be transgender or non-binary or lesbian or gay.
Yeah, I'll throw another term on the table. There's also a term called accomplice.
So being accomplice.
Being an accomplice to the LGBT community as an actually being out there and disrupting the forces that are oppressing LGBTQI people. So that might mean calling your representatives, going to rallies. I think one thing that could be really important is attending school board meetings, joining your local school board.
Yes.
Forgive me, I don't know the name of the county or the town, but very recently, within the last 2 weeks, there was a push by a local school board to partner with a conservative far-right law group to remove LGBTQI content from the curriculum. And so being on your school board and preventing that from happening is one way to be an accomplice that protects not just your child, if you have a child in a public school, but also generally the community at whole. Those children are going to graduate. They're going to go out into the world. So how can you actually be there disrupting disinformation or hate? That's a way to be an accomplice.
And vote. Get out and vote. If you support LGBTQ plus rights, which are human rights, if you believe that every citizen should be treated the same way and not a second class citizen, get out and vote and make your opinion known.
I want to go back to the Stonewall Uprising. For some of us that may not understand what that is and how it even sparked the Pride movement, could one of you or both of you speak to that?
Sure. Well, back in the day, LGBTQ plus people didn't have any rights. Being a member of the LGBTQ plus community, you could be thrown in jail.
Wow.
Because basically, your existence was in question, right? You could spend time in prison because of your sexual orientation or gender identity. And in Stonewall in New York, basically the police were targeting particularly gay men and transgender women and other members of the LGBTQ plus community. But they would go into bars and they would arrest individuals and blackmail them, beat them, do whatever. And finally, members of the LGBTQ plus community said, enough is enough. And they said, no more are we going to take this. We're going to fight back, and we're going to assert the fact that we are American citizens and we deserve to be treated in the same way as any other American citizen.
Yeah, I think important to note about Stonewall, too, is that the people who were leading the movement were people of color and trans people. Marsha P. Johnson, Sylvia Rivera, they were the people who really started the riots and the movement as a whole. I think that often gets lost when we're talking about this in the mainstream.
Yeah.
When it comes to the study that you two conducted, what went into it?
Well, it wasn't just two of us. It's a
team
of people,
so many
right?
People.
Yeah, we have 12 years of data now, 2011 to 2022 for 204 countries and territories. We have a database that, and you can access actually our information if you're more interested. It's just the www.fnmglobalbarometers.org. All that information is on the website. And basically, it did take a lot of time. It did take a lot of effort, but it's about teamwork and getting that information out.
When you looked at the people in the queer community here in Central PA, how exactly did they feel?
Well, it it depends. They, again, I think when it came to LGBTQ plus people, if you're talking about queer specifically, we can disaggregate by identity, and that's one of the powerful elements of the survey, that we can see how lesbians felt, how gay men felt, how trans women felt, how trans men felt, non-binary, queer, and intersex. And in fact, we also have the largest data set on intersex individuals globally. But again, generally, queer people, LGBTQ plus people, felt relatively unaccepted in the Susquehanna Valley. And that's, again, something that we need to look at as a community. Why do our LGBTQ plus brothers and sisters feel unaccepted? What can we do better to make them feel a part of our community, a part of a valued community, and share in their human dignity?
Yeah, and just more specifically to your question, right, remember, we grade on a scale of 0 to 100%, just like you would in a normal classroom, and Pennsylvania scores a C overall, and that's true as well if you break it down regionally or by city. Philadelphia scored an average of 72%, Pittsburgh a 76%, and then the Susquehanna Valley a 72%, so they're tied with Philadelphia. But they actually, in the Susquehanna Valley, showed a lower level of acceptance than Pittsburgh and Philadelphia at a 65%. So the acceptance seems to be the lowest in the Susquehanna Valley.
Is there a website where we can stay up to date with the F&M Global Barometer's research?
There sure is. It's the F&M Global Barometer's website. It's www.fnmglobalbarometers.org. And that's spelled out F-A-N-D-M, Global Barometer's, all one word, .org.
Thank you so much, Dr. Dicklich Nelson and Aaron Hallenbach, for being with us and sharing your research with us. And thank you for listening. And make sure you're following us on Facebook, like our page, The Spark, to stay connected. Have a great rest of your day. I'm Asia Tabb.